Hi, I'm Jesse Driscoll. I'm here with Christian Davenport, and we're bringing you the Raiders of the Lost Archive. Archives are repositories of special information. Archives can take many forms, historical documents, oral histories, or data sets that can't just be downloaded. We're asking questions to allow some special guests to speak candidly about their research process. Conversations will be archived here with the social science community. Thanks for listening, and enjoy.
So we're talking today with Sarah Cameron. She is an associate professor of history at the University of Maryland and the author of the award-winning book, Hungry Step, on the cause of the famine. Sarah, welcome to Raiders of the Lost Archive.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So initially, what is the topic or question that you were interested in examining when you wanted to start the field?
So initially when I went to start my field work, I was really interested in looking at the Kazakh famine of the 1930s. I had gone to get a PhD in Soviet history, and when I was working my PhD, I became increasingly interested in the history of the Soviet East, which I felt had been a lot less explored than that of the Soviet Union's West. I had to pick a republic to focus on. I decided to focus on Kazakhstan simply because it had been less explored. Even less explored than some of the other Central Asian republics. And I went there, and when I was there, I started flipping through kids' history textbooks, and I noticed that they were talking about this famine in which a quarter of the population died. This is under Stalin during the Soviet period. And I thought to myself, you know, this is really odd. I have never heard of this famine whatsoever.
So when did you go for the first time when you're going through these history textbooks? When was that?
So the first time I went to Kazakhstan was when I began learning Kazakh. I already knew Russian. So Kazakhstan has two major languages, Kazakh and Russian. And the first time I went probably would have been in 2005, I believe. And that's where I first got the idea of working on the famine, was actually just sort of talking to people, flipping through kids' history textbooks. And I realized that there was actually nothing about this massive famine, which was one of I think one of the most consequential results of Stalin's policies in any of the textbooks, secondary literature that I was using in graduate school. So I really set out to investigate this famine. What were the causes of this famine, and what were its consequences for Kazakhs, for Kazakh society, and then how does that change the nature of what we think of as Stalinism?
I have two, actually. One, kind of what led you to children's books, and second, answer that one first.
Okay, what led me to kids' books? Well, probably at the time, I think I was actually trying to develop a research vocabulary, and a lot of the kids' history textbooks during that period are written, they're written for kids, so they're written in a vocabulary that's a little bit more accessible than, more advanced secondary literature. So I think at the time I probably wanted to start with that. And then also, at least in the West, if you think about works in English, we still don't have to a great deal an overview of what happened in Kazakhstan during the Soviet period. So just as an outsider, someone who's totally unfamiliar with this, I just wanted a narrative of what actually happened. And so that's why I started looking at kids' history textbooks.
Yeah, I've been fascinated by it now. There's some friends I have at UT Austin who studied how different elements of American history find themselves in the children's textbooks. And I just realized, well, they probably exist everywhere, right? So it's an amazing source of information. So I was wondering about that. But so as you were preparing to go and informing folks that you were off to do your research, what was the kind of response? What were people telling you about what you should be preparing for, what they thought would happen, so forth?
Well, that was the time at which I was preparing to go. This was the time at which Borat was pretty big. So I got a lot of Borat jokes. actually, I notice I don't really get any Borat jokes anymore, but at the time I got a lot. And I always used to say that actually Borat was very good for my career because it really sparked people's interest in Kazakhstan. They were very interested. I got a lot of reactions of, gosh, that's going to be really difficult. I don't know if you're going to be able to do that sort of project, because it was not, it was something that was further east. It was not in Moscow. It was in Central Asia, which had been, you know, less explored. My dissertation advisor was kind of visibly uncomfortable, actually, when I first suggested going to Central Asia. She then got more reassured when I, you know, she made me, which was right, talk to a huge group of people to reassure her and me that the project actually could be done and that I could do this as a female researcher.
How did you look at those people? That's...
That networking. You have to talk to, you know, you have to talk to people. You also, I found, not just talk to famous Professor X, but talk to the graduate student who was there most recently. So it was a lot of emailing people, talking to people. At the time I went there, not that many foreigners had worked in the archive. There really was, you know, only, you know, 10, 15 people, something like that.
So did you arrive in a way that allowed you to go immediately to the archives? Not on your first trip when you were doing language acquisition, but second trip. Did you essentially show up with a stamped embossed letter at the archives and explain what you were doing and just get started, or was it more complicated than that?
It was more or less like that, although, again, I feel like developing research vocabulary in your research language is so key, and that was a... that was still a several months long process. And also figuring out, you know, how to navigate the archives themselves and how, you know, what to order. That is something that took a long, long time. I feel like I was not terribly efficient, actually, in the first few weeks I was there. What I did, you know, for my work, there was important research materials in the archives, but there were also really important research materials in the libraries. Because a lot of the materials I was looking at are from the 1920s and 1930s. So things like books that only had very small production runs that were produced in the 1920s, and also things like newspapers and journals that were produced in the 1920s and 30s. These are things that are not normally, or in that period, there were not good collecting arrangements between the Soviet Union and the West. So these materials, they just don't exist anywhere else outside of Kazakhstan and sometimes Russia. So I was also doing a lot of work in the library too, and that was a little bit, the rules in the library were a little bit easier to navigate. So I noticed in the first part of my time, I probably spent a little bit more time in the library just to help me develop, you know, the research vocabulary, help me gain a little bit more confidence. And then over time, I began to spend more time in the archives too.
Because many of our listeners are political scientists, and political scientists are interlopers in the archives at best. You've used the phrase now, research vocabulary, three times. It's clearly a term of art for you, and I want to make sure that our listeners know what it is that you're loving into that and what utility you get out of it as a historian.
Well, I guess research vocabulary, I think actually during the Soviet period, there was rather a narrow range of words that people used. And there were also a lot of shorthands. They used a lot of abbreviations and shorthands to refer to various commissariats, to refer to various commissions. And unless you know all of this, it actually can be really, really overwhelming. It can actually be overwhelming for someone who's a native speaker, even, until you get familiar with some of these terms. And so, you know, it took me sometimes coming home with my notes at night, pouring through them a little bit, or reading, you know, secondary literature about the period, for me to become more familiar with some of these terms and then move a bit more swiftly through some of the archival documents.
This is great. We're interested in trying to get someone's general kind of like arc of exposure and experience. And so part of that is, so you get in, you start kind of immersing yourself and like, what are your first thoughts about what it is that you're seeing? And then kind of following on that, kind of like, what were your second thoughts of kind of like having gone through that initial waiting and then reflecting a little bit and then kind of that second wave of immersion?
Well, you know, I was lucky in that I chose a topic that was everywhere. You could not open up a file from the late 1920s and early 1930s without seeing the famine smack right there. And so that actually became the challenge for me from the beginning, was how do I, I could spend 10 years looking at documents about the famine. And I was actually very lucky in that sense, because some people pick topics that are not so easy to find in the archives. For me, it was how do I deal with this overwhelming, you know, mass of information? And also, how do I, on a personal level, you know, you come across these terrible, terrible stories, and how do you deal with that day after day, and how do you make sense of that? How do you craft that actually into a narrative? And so that, you know, for me, adopting a slightly more targeted approach over time was really helpful. And I think over time I began to think a little bit more about how would I structure it, you know, the project into different chapters. I think that helped me figure out how to target my research efforts a little bit more, you know, and also taking the time to sort of midway through my project, figure out, you know, what questions do I think I really have enough information to answer? And what big questions have I not yet answered? And what other files, what other collections should I look at to answer those questions?
So quick follow-up. We haven't really been explicit on the interviews that we've done thus far on the issue of kind of like mental health amidst horror, but we study topics that kind of do have us delve into that, especially the folks that do some things in archives. They might see some things that is not popularly known, or the sheer abundance of horror is kind of like overwhelming. So partly kind of like, so how did you, if I may, how did you manage that? How did you kind of like find your path to kind of like deal with it? And as you're thinking about assisting or talking to past us, in a sense, talking to other people that are about to do that or going to do that, what was like a best practice that was really helpful for you, if you believe you did it well? So, I mean, you're here, so that counts a great deal. Yeah. So,
you know, it's an important question. It's also, for instance, there's now been an effort in Kazakhstan to collect, to collect a lot of archival documents about the famine, to put together document collections. And I know actually some of the archivists who have put together these document collections, their mental health has really suffered. Some of them have not actually been able to continue on in the project because they found it to be that difficult and that overwhelming. You know, I think for me, one of the things that really that helped me a little bit over time was I really felt like in reading all of these documents, it's easy sometimes for the stories to blur together. But one thing I really set out to do in my writing and to do in the book was to center the Kazakh story, to really make clear that this is one of the great crimes of the Stalinist regime, and to put Kazakhs themselves at the center of the story. So I really tried as much as I could, actually, and it's very difficult because Kazakhs at this time period, they were a nomadic society. And if you know anything about nomads, of course, they leave far fewer traces in the written records. They're largely an oral society rather than a literate society. But I tried as much as I could to really tell the story through the voices of Kazakhs themselves. And I felt that was one way that I could really actually honor, you know, many of the people who died and bring their voices to light. I would say, though, for me, I definitely had difficult moments in the archives. The more difficult moments for me actually were after the book was published, because then Kazakhs began to write. Jesse can tell you, the book had this extraordinary reaction in Kazakhstan, where the famine still remains a largely forbidden topic, and it has sparked off all kinds of debate and reactions, and various Kazakhs began to write to me and tell me stories about their families, and to tell me, you know, things that the regime still will not acknowledge about mass killings and these sorts of things. And somehow this personal connection with people whose relatives had endured this I found to be quite personally affecting. And I, at that point, I felt much more acutely the responsibility of what I was doing.
So I have to ask a follow-up question to all of this, but to wind the clock back to the initial stages of what you said, has this given you any insight or different theories perhaps on the question of why no one had written on this before? You said that you were drawn to this topic in part because, you know, contra the famine in Ukraine, where there's not only a secondary history, there's complicated debates that you can spend a lifetime trying to master, whether genocide is the right term, that kind of thing. And there's nothing like that in on the Kazakh famine. So I know you addressed this a little bit in the book, but I hope you'll do it for us here. Do you know why that is in a better sense now than you did before as a result of the...
Why the Kazakh famine hasn't been addressed by Kazakhs themselves?
Yeah.
Well, do I have a better understanding?
Or by any number of, historians in the diaspora or Russian historians, or... I mean, it wouldn't have to just be Kazakhs.
I think that, you know, as I talk a little bit about it in the book, I think that evolutionary theory has a lot to do with this. The idea that Kazakhs were nomads and they were settled after the famine, brutally settled, something like a third of all Kazakhs perished. But I think in the back of many people's minds, this idea that there was something natural about this, I think that has a big, and you actually even notice it in how people talk about the Kazakh famine in the literature, that it was a tragedy, that it was somehow inevitable that this was going to happen, that there was something kind of natural about it. I don't think people looked at it, quite saw the violence of what actually happened. And so I think the Kazakh famine is part of a broader story about how we marginalize the stories of nomadic peoples. I think other reasons for not talking about the Kazakh story in Kazakhstan themselves, we need a better study, but surely the relationship with Russia is part of it. I was very fortunate as an outside researcher to have the time and the resources that it really takes to put together a study like this. You know, it's many, many, many years of work, and I think many Kazakhstani historians just don't have that luxury.
Kind of related to that kind of arc or trajectory of engagement with the materials and the research project, what kind of troubles or opportunities did you come across as you were doing the work that either kind of like set up roadblocks for you or open doors that you didn't even know were closed?
Troubles along the way, certainly I found that the position of being an American worked both ways. So the position of being an American was actually kind of interesting because it could open up, it could, as you might suspect, there would be roadblocks. You know, I found that one archive I wanted to look at, I tried a regional archive, they called me and said, no, you can only look at that, you know, you're a foreigner, you can only look at American, you can only look at that if you are if you get special permission from the KGB. Well, that's not going to happen. That's essentially saying the archive is closed to you. But I also found that it could work in the reverse way, that people were actually genuinely excited that I was an American researcher and that I was going to explain this problem to an American audience. Mm. And I think actually you see that in the reaction to my book, because there have been other studies published about the Kazakh famine by foreign scholars. But my book somehow, because it was, and I think in some part because it was written by an American, for many Kazakhs, the reaction to it, they perceived that, oh, finally, the world stage has recognized this problem. And so that's why so many, I think, have kind of reacted to it in the way that they did. Being an American scholar could open up doors for me. I found people wanted to give me things, they wanted to show me things, they wanted to talk to me about certain things in a way that, you know, if I had been another nationality, they might not have wanted to. I also found, there were, some problems you might expect, problems with heat and air conditioning in the archives. And, you know, some days I was just sitting there sweltering, some days I was freezing. I also frequently encountered problems with files being under restoration. So they're saying, you know, you can't see that because those files are being restored. And then sometimes if you had certain connections or workarounds, then you could actually see those files. Or sometimes maybe you actually had to come back 6 months later. But this is a common problem.
So let's stay on this and just talk about process a little bit. You talked about how this is a very large investment of resources. Obviously, the most precious resource is your time, as you were getting, as we're hinting at when you talked about the acquisition of a research vocabulary. How do you actually use your time? What do you do? Were you using a scanner to scan documents and then look at them on your computer later? Were you doing everything with note cards? Just walk us through your process.
I was pretty much doing everything by hand because that was what was allowed in that period. Now it's changed. Now I know that. So I should say I worked in both Kazakhstan and in Russia. At that point, I think some of the Russian archives were allowing computers. But I had become so used to doing it by hand that I just wrote my notes by hand. And I did that also purposely because I had hoped that my book, and it ended up ultimately happening, that my book would be translated into Russian and Kazakh. And obviously, if it's going to be translated, you need the originals. You need the original quotations. And also I wanted to make sure that my translations were very accurate, and I didn't want to be doing that on the fly. I wanted to have the originals, and I can't type very well in Russian or in Kazakh. So I just made that decision to take my notes by hand. Some of the Kazakh archives also had policies whereby they wouldn't, or most of them, I think all of them in that time period had policies. They wouldn't allow computers in. One archive said you can do photocopies, but the photocopier was always broken or produced copies that were of no use whatsoever. So pretty much I took all of my notes by hand.
Okay, so we're trying to capture the humanity involved in archiving of sorts. And so part of that involves identifying the tragic and the comedic. You might have touched on the tragic already that you came across in the archives, but if something stood out especially as profound and earth-shattering, for lack of a better phrase, to be balanced by the comedic kind of, you just found this to be completely hilarious. Well, what comes to mind as you think about it?
So the tragic, there were a couple episodes of utter sort of inhumanity that I encountered, stories that I would read in their archives. And one, I don't know, still even many years later, I can't make sense of it. So in the late parts of the famine, Moscow sends food aid. But a lot of this, and people are starving, they're desperate at this point. But some of this food aid doesn't actually reach people because the people who are supposed to distribute it, bundle it. And in one of the stories, I was reading an archival document, a man decides he has this paperwork to distribute food aid in his pocket, but he decides basically that he's going to organize a big wedding for a relative, and he goes and gets drunk for several weeks, all the while people are dying, and he doesn't pass on the paperwork that would have enabled these people to get the food that they needed.
Wow.
And that was one of the most sort of, I'm still many years later trying to make sense of that particular story. I guess one of the most comical things I encountered in the archives was actually with a member of the archival staff. There was a book that many books in Kazakhstan, even books published today, had very small print runs. So I was often running around bookstores trying to buy up things because you can't get them in the U.S. And I saw a book in closed behind glass in one of the archives that I was working in. And I said, you know, I would love to get some Xeroxes out of the book. And the lady said to me, no way, we can't Xerox that book or any part of it. And then when I was going up the stairs one day, one of the archival workers said to me, you know, I can get you a Xerox from that book. Just slip me a little money and I'll do it. And so I gave him some money. We negotiated it all. And then eventually later he said, you know, I can't give you the book in the archive, the Xerox is from it, but let's meet in the underpass near the archive. And so he gave me the Xeroxes in the underpass. And of course, I actually never used any of those documents in my book. But I thought it was a good story, you know?
Definitely.
Sure is. What did you do when you were in the archives? So I know that it's easy to focus on the data collection process, but, you know, on the human side of it, tell us a little bit about where you were when you were off-site. Off-site in country.
Off-site in country, so meaning when I was not at the library or not in the archives.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I was fortunate in that there were a good group. You know, there were a number of other foreign researchers who were working there, not a huge amount, but a couple. And I definitely talked to them. You know, we would meet up for drinks occasionally, and that really, really helped. But over time, I was lucky in that I made a couple of really great Kazakh friends. And so that also helped just to, you know, to get out with them, to talk to them. I traveled a bit also elsewhere in Central Asia.
So was there, just kind of a two-part question, was there anything from the archives that you learned kind of midway through that radically changed the trajectory of the project? Or was there anything that you learned from those social connections that radically changed the project?
Well, a lot of the social connections, you know, again, I was lucky in that I just had a topic that most ordinary Kazakhs could understand why this was important to explain to an American audience. And so I was really lucky in that people just, you know, taxi cab drivers, they would strike up conversations with me, you know, and that a lot of those conversations, they helped me think about, you know, why hasn't this topic been talked about in Kazakhstan? Why has this topic not been talked about in the West? Those helped me kind of shed new light on it. It also, some of those conversations and sort of being surrounded by Kazakh culture today, where they place a lot of emphasis on their nomadic heritage, that also made me realize that, you know, one of the crucial goals I had to do in the book was I had to explain what a nomad was. This was very confusing for people in my field who are not used to hearing about nomads. Very confusing for a lot of people. So I had to spend a lot of time in the book really conveying very, very clearly what that was and why it was so catastrophic both to Kazakh's economic way of life and to their culture when this was destroyed. Because nomadism is not just an economic practice, it was a really important part of their culture.
So I'm curious, in many of the conversations we end up having, either people give their opinions and suggestions and training up front and they get to the field and it's completely worthless, or there's some gems in there that were, I wish I got more of that. Which are you?
I think I got a lot of advice about cultivating relationships with people, and that was really important in the archives that I worked in. You know, trying to get to know some of the archivists. Sometimes it didn't work in my favor. You know, I never ended up having a relationship with them, but sometimes it actually did. I think advice I got about, maybe it would be different now, but, you know, being able to use a lot of technology, photographs, cameras, these sorts of things, it just didn't work for me.
That's good.
Do you think that when you say that it might be different now, I mean, is that speculation or do you have evidence that the field is changing?
I've been astonished, actually. So the major archive that I worked in is the Presidential Archives in Kazakhstan. It's an amazing archive. Very lucky when I came because they had just released a lot of new document collections. But they had very, very restrictive policies when I was there. I couldn't Xerox anything. No Xeroxes, no photographs allowed. In fact, one of the most interesting things was that they kept my notebook that I handwrote my notes in, and they checked it. And only once they had checked it could I actually take it home with me. So I took to buying very small notebooks because I was always so terrified that they were going to take my notebook entirely and I would lose several weeks of work. And now I'm astonished talking to, you know, other graduate students who have worked there in recent years that they've actually, they now allow people to use cameras. They no longer have this silly notebook checking policy. So they've really moved forward.
The detail of having small notebooks is worth the cost of the buy-in of this podcast. This is fantastic, fantastic. Thank you so much for that. Do you think that that's because of the liberalization of Kazakh politics? I mean, is this ultimately just the story about the fact that Kazakhstan is less of a paranoid dictatorship with respect to researchers from abroad? Or do you think this is just the natural march of technology and everyone's giving up? Or, I mean, what do you attribute that change to?
That's very interesting. Yeah, I think that...
I've noticed the same thing. I've heard the same thing from researchers in Central Asia and even Russia, which is why I ask.
I think that it's part of that, maybe, you know, the first factor that you gestured to, liberalization. I mean, in talking to archivists from Kazakhstan, they are very eager to be in touch with best practices in the West, what's being done in the West. However, I do think that probably we have to make a distinction between different archival systems in Kazakhstan. So, you know, this is a former Soviet republic. There are two archival systems. One is the former Communist Party, and the other one is the institutions of the state. And state archives tend to be much more poorly funded than the former Communist Party archives. And so in Kazakhstan, at least the presidential archives, which is the former Communist Party archives, they just have a lot more money and a lot more means and, you know, the money to investigate these new strategies of how to manage an archive than the state archives do.
Sarah, I'm very much appreciating the kind of care and reflectiveness you give to your answers. I like that. I'm curious, related partially to kind of what we were just discussing, but as you kind of inform your students or you think about how the field has changed, what do you think emerges from your experience that serves as like the core advice that you give to people that are going to do archival work?
I always sit down, well, I try to sit down with graduate students and advise them before they go. I made a lot of trial and error. I do feel there was a lot of wasted time in my research, but perhaps that's just inevitable, you know, the first time that you go in. But I do advise them to come up with a good research system, a way for collecting the data. I felt like I just didn't have a good system, you know, for, like, ideally you should have a system, for instance, each archival file you look at where you have the date, where you have the title of the file, where you have who it's addressed to, you know, who has signed it, the page numbers, all of these things. And I was sort of writing it down by hand, and I was meaning to collect all of these things, but I didn't, you get tired in the archives. You need to have a system that forces you to do this each time. And, you know, also I would advise them to think about what the standard has become in their field for the sorts of evidence you need to collect. So to give you an example, I realized after I did my research that it had sort of become the standard in my field, not just to refer to the collection number, the page number, but also in the footnote, but also to include the date, to include the title of the file, to include, you know, who this document is directed to, because that obviously gives you a lot more information and it can tell you how to interpret the document. Give you a little bit more information about how that scholar interpreted the document. So it was actually after I finished my dissertation and when I was spending time revising them that I realized, gosh, I didn't necessarily do the best job with collecting that information. And on subsequent research trips, I tried to actually solidify my footnotes a little bit and get that information so that my footnotes were a little bit more solid.
Sarah, thank you very much for your time. Sure. And thanks for being on the podcast.
Yeah, no problem.
Hello, thank you for listening to Raiders of the Lost Archive. And for writings mentioned in this podcast, as well as what we're going to be doing in the future, please feel free to look at archiveraiders.weebly.com.